This podcast is a part of Straight Up Strange Productions. Discover more shows like this one at straightupstrange.com.
Welcome back to the Oddball Aussie Podcast. I'm your host, Oz Oddball. Thank you for joining me. On tonight's show, just a warning, we're going to be talking about the Machine Elves, also known as the DMT Elves. So there will be some talk of drug use and things like that throughout this episode. I do not condone the use of any drugs, but it's an interesting topic, so we're going to have a crack at it. All right, so before we go on, make sure you're following me on Twitter, at Aussie Oddball. The Instagram and the Facebook page is The Oddball Aussie Podcast. You can also find me on TeePublic, the Oddball Aussie Podcast, and buy some merch there, support the show. Check it all out. Also, if you want to check out the network that I'm a part of, that is straightupstrange.com, and their Twitter is straightupstrange. So check it out. Some great podcasts on there, and I'm sure you'll really enjoy it. Check them all out. There's enough to fill your whole week full of podcasts and goodies. There's also some great artists over there as well. So one of which I'll be doing an interview with soon about art and witchcraft. So that should be, keep an eye on the horizon for that. Alrighty. So I'm still recovering from losing my voice over the weekend. So bear with me. But I think the voice is sounding better than it did during the news episode at the start of the week, which I hope you're all enjoying that. I'm doing those every Monday. They'll be about 20 to 40 minutes long, depending. But I hope you like that. It's a little bit off the cuff. It's a little bit interesting. So anyway, let's check out Machine Elves or DMT Elves. Very interesting concept. Now, what essentially is it? Well, we're talking about a hallucination that people have seen all around the world, multiple people. And this is very, very interesting because there's also another hallucination that is of a mantis that eats a person when they're under this hallucination. But today we're talking about the Machine Elves. A lot of people believe that this is a phenomenon where using DMT or any type of drug that has tryptamine in it will cause you to go basically ascend to another level where you're interacting with creatures from a different dimension or a different plane of existence. It's quite an interesting thought. But there's obviously not evidence that this exists, otherwise that'd be world-changing, game-changing. But there's definitely a lot of people saying that they've had these same experiences. Well, there is some medical and scientific reasoning behind this, but there's also a lot of theological beliefs in this as well, a lot of theological reasoning behind it. Some people saying that it's definitely a real thing. There's definitely these transcended beings that they're seeing in another dimension. Some people think it's aliens. Some people think it's ghosts or paranormal. And others just think it's exactly what they think it is. It's a hallucination. But could it be something? Generations of different tribes around the world and native peoples have been using different drugs that have tryptamine in them to contact ancestors, to contact spirits, and they believe that this could be a connection to that. Ayahuasca in South America is a very interesting one to keep an eye out for, because that's one that a lot of people use as a ethnobotany product. Not 100% legal, none of this is, but in some places it is. Especially for cultures that use this stuff as medicine. So we'll go into ethnobotany as well as we go along. So to begin with, I figured we better sort of, because I don't believe everyone who watches my show probably knows a lot about drugs all the time. There's probably a lot that do, and good on you. But for those who aren't quite up to date with it, so what is DMT? Dimethyltryptamine, and I'm not going to say how many times I had to redo that take, is a chemical substance that occurs in many plants and animals in which it is both a derivative and a structural analog of tryptamine. It is used as a psychedelic drug and prepared by various cultures for ritual purposes as an entheogen. DMT has rapid onset intense effects and relatively short duration of action. So we're talking about a 1 minute high. So 1 minute to get onto the high, and it lasts for about maybe 5 minutes at the most. Stronger dosages obviously will result in a longer and stronger high. For those reasons, DMT was known as the business trip during the 60s in the United States, as a user could access the full depth of a psychedelic experience in considerably less time than with other substances such as LSD or magic mushrooms. DMT can be inhaled, ingested, or injected, and its effects depend on the dose, as well as its mode of administration. When inhaled or injected, the effects last a short period of time, about 5 to 15 minutes. Effects can last 3 hours or more when orally ingested, along with an MAOI, such as the ayahuasca brew of many native Amazonian tribes. DMT can produce vivid projections of mystical experiences involving euphoria and dynamic hallucinations of geometric forms. And that is what we're focusing on today, is these machine demons, also known as, so these go by multiple different names, and these names can range from the fractal elves, I just call them demons, no, well that's another part of the story, fractal elves, self-transforming elves, elf machines, clockwork elves, or also known as demons or angels to some people, depending on your skew. I guess it's a, I wonder if it's a glass half empty type of thing. You know, one person's angel is another person's demon, I guess. So tryptamine, yep, it's in a lot of different drugs, mostly all psychotropic and all hallucinogens that are a natural based psychotropic or hallucinogen will have some sort of tryptamine in them. And so we're not talking so much your man-made stuff. A lot of DMT is man-made, but obviously coming from a natural source. So the machine elves, and why are they found in DMT? What are machine elves? Machine elves is the term Terence McKenna used to describe the entities one encounters when launched into the unfathomable realm of DMT. Machine elves are hyperdimensional sentient beings that love to play with whomever they can play with. If you as a human begin to decide to enter the realm through DMT, they will most likely want to play with you. If you carry with you lots of identity and egoic attachments, they will strip you naked and unveil something which you may or may not be ready to witness. These super-dimensional elves are sentient beings just like you, me, the dog barking, the cat meowing. They also have a sense of the primordial thought that all physical sentient beings have in this existence. So that's an interesting way of looking at it. And a lot of people, when they talk about the ego attachments and things like that, there's a big following of people that say that, yeah, people who are full of ego, people full of who pump themselves up, they will actually believe that they're better and smarter than what they actually are. So when they go on to DMT, it's their own ego being stripped aside. So it's their brain bringing forth their own fears. Whereas someone who is, say, a very out there, cruisy type of person who, let's say a hippie, were to take it, it could result in an exacerbation of those dreamy, cruisy type of vibes, or it could actually bring forward a feeling of dread, of control, something taking control of them and taking away their freedom. So it's very different depending on who takes it. But these machine elves that people see tend to be the a very baseline thing that a lot of people are seeing. A popular description of what they are approximately are by McKenna says, namely self-transforming machine elves, which we as human beings can communicate with, similar to how we can express ourselves semantically with other human beings. The communication with machine elves is done through the medium of direct thought, transference, and or visual language. So what they're talking about here is there's a big belief that when people communicate with these machine elves, that they're actually they're telepathically talking to them. And when they do speak, when they're going through one of these trips, they verbalize visuals. So they might verbalize, they might talk, and from their mouth they will see coming geometric patterns. They may see light or glowing or things like that happening from their mouth. So the mouth becomes basically disconnected, and they have to. And you've got to remember, this all happens between 5 and 15 minutes. 15 minutes is a long one. So on average, between 5 to 10 minutes, this is happening. And people will believe that they're actually verbalizing thoughts, and not by what you and I would normally think verbalizing a thought is. They will actually say something, and what is pictured in their head will come out of their mouth. Very interesting idea. And within this 5 to 10 minutes, they're actually learning how to communicate in a whole different way. What the machine elves essentially are is up for grabs. They can be highly intelligent, sentient beings living simultaneously in our universe, though in more subtle dimensions, or they can be our ancestors living in some kind of ecology of souls. There's also a belief that the... where they come from is that they're an ascended being of what we are, and this is a way of communicating them. Now, personally, this I hear this a lot from people who like taking this stuff, and part of me does question whether is this an excuse just to take more of it. There's a whole group of people called psychonauts that we'll get into later, who basically live on this stuff. So it's. For some, it's a whole new universe of experiences. For others, it's I need excuses to get high. I honestly do believe that there is that group out there. I'm not saying psychonauts are that group. I'm just saying that, yeah, there are people who like to make excuses just so they can get high. So a machine elf visually looks like exactly what you would think, a small elf-like creature, pointy ears, and generally a geometric pattern on their face and their body. Their body could be made up of all different types of shapes. Occasionally it can be made up of different types of textures as well. Some people will say that they will see these little fairy elf type creatures, and their hair will look like carpet, their face will look like skin, their arms will look like machines, so they'll look like wires and circuit boards and things like that. Others will just see pure geometric shapes and nothing but a geometric shape. So they will see think of a origami type person. If you would make a person out of origami, they're seeing that, but within those shapes, they're seeing even more shapes. And others see it as a normal walking human being, the same shape and size of all of us, but their skin and their face will be made up of geometric patterns, as if getting a new texture pack on a video game. I guess it's quite an interesting. It's all very dependent upon the person. Others will say they look nothing like a human at all, and all they see is a floating head, or they'll see a scurrying body type of thing. So when we do say that people are having the same experiences, they're not the same per se. They're the same as they all have this thought in their head of a machine elf, a clockwork elf. Elf is a fairly common term that's used, whereas the actual visual of the elf may be completely different from person to person. So we will talk about Terence McKenna as well and what ethnobotany is. But right now, the references to such encounters can be found in many cultures ranging from shamanic traditions of Native Americans to Indigenous Australians and African tribes, as well as among Western users of these substances. Australia does not have machine elves. At about minute one or two of a DMT trip, according to McKenna, one may burst through a chrysanthemum-like mandala and find there's a whole bunch of entities waiting on the other side, saying, "How wonderful that you're here. You come so rarely. We're so delighted to see you." They're like jeweled self-dribbling basketballs, and there are many of them, and they come pounding towards you, and they will stop in front of you and vibrate. But then they do a very disconcerting thing, which is they'll jump in and out of the person's body, and they'll start playing games with the person. They'll giggle and laugh, and doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing for the person. McKenna would actually say, do not let them get behind you, because it's from behind you is where they will actually do some nasty stuff to try and hurt you, which is comedy to them, but not so much to you. The whole thing is going on in a high-speed mode where you're being presented with thousands of ideas per second, and you can't hold on to any of them. And these things are saying, don't give in to astonishment, which is exactly what you want to do. You want to go nuts with how crazy this is. And they say, don't do that. Pay attention to what we're doing. What they're doing is making objects with their voices, singing structures into existence. They offer things to you saying, look at this, look at this. And as your attention grows towards these objects, you realize that you're being shown an impossible. It's not simple, intricate, beautiful, and hard to manufacture. It's impossible. It's impossible to make these things. The nearest analogy would be a Fabergé egg. But these things are like the toys that are scattered around the nursery inside of a UFO. Celestial toys, and toys themselves appear to be somehow alive and can sing other objects into. They can sing other objects into existence. So what's happening is this proliferation of elf gifts, which are moving around singing and are saying, "Do what we are doing." And they are insistent. They say, do it, do it, do it. And you feel like a bubble inside your body. You begin to move up towards your mouth. And then when it comes out, it isn't sound, it's vision. You discover that you can pump stuff out of your mouth by singing. And they're urging you to do this. They say, that's it, keep it going. We're now at minute 4.5 of the trip and you speak in a kind of glossalia. There's a spontaneous outpouring of syntax unaccompanied by what is normally called meaning. After a minute or so, this whole thing begins to collapse in on itself and they begin to physically move away from you. Usually their final shot is what they wave goodbye and they say deja vu, deja vu. This concept may be related to a tendency of the brain to imagine living entities during the certain altered states. So for instance, when people will picture angels or demons when they're being put under anesthetic before they go in for surgery, or after when they're coming out of surgery, or even during surgery, people have had hallucinations. This can also be sleep paralysis. The same thing happens during sleep paralysis. And we've done a whole episode last year on sleep paralysis, so definitely please check that out. And the idea of a succubus or an incubus or a demon or an angel that comes to you, or not so much an angel in the sense of sleep paralysis, also these white beings that sit at the end of your bed, things like this, shadow people. These are all hallucinations that McKenna ties into the same type of effect and suggests that possibly these are the same creatures, but they're choosing to come see us in those instances, whereas the DMT trip is making us go and see them. Once again, I don't condone going and having a DMT trip. I know Joe Rogan's always asking people, like, "Zoo, where you tried DMT?" Well, I can't say I have, but and the stuff I'm hearing here is scary as hell. So what happens essentially when we're talking about these hallucinations and seeing these beings in any other form? It happens as well during DMT trips, but dopamine receptors from a protein on the outside of a certain cell, which binds to dopamine, this is active in the part of the brain called the pineal gland. Pineal gland, aka the third eye. Now, we've talked about this a few times in the past, and it's accessing your third eye to be able to see through to other dimensions. There's a belief that humankind, our ancestors, there's a whole alien belief that there was a group of people who existed here before us and that we were created by them, and that they left the planet, or even the galaxy long ago. They ascended or they were chased away and we were left behind. And the belief is that they actually had a physical third eye in their middle of the head middle of the forehead. And there's a belief that we were created by them as a experiment or as a working slave group. And from there, when they left, we were left to our own devices. There are a lot of people believe that this is where our God beliefs come from. This is where our spirituality comes from. And a lot of people believe that when they created us, we were essentially clones of them without their powers. So a lot of people say that there's many, many groups of extraterrestrial researchers, interdimensional researchers, hyperdimensional researchers. Add anything in front of dimensional and you've got a word nowadays. But you'll find that a lot of those types of groups will talk about things. Well, you'll find people within these groups who will talk about these ancestor species who have left. It ties into ancient aliens. You'll hear Sukalos talk a lot about this type of thing with the ancient aliens, that we were created by them for them, and then they've basically pissed off and left us, or they've been wiped out. That's the other side of it. Now, the idea is that they took away, they mutated us, and they cloned us so we didn't have the physical third eye, but we still have connection there because they need to be able to connect with us in some way. So I'm following the train. I'm understanding the thought bubble of it. I mean, we've never found anything archaeological that would suggest a skull that has a third eye in it. Some people say that's a metaphorical third eye, and that these other ancestor creatures look nothing like us. Some people say that they were already ascended when they created us. I'm going to look more into it throughout the year, but I'll tell you now, it's huge. There's so many different theories to this sort of stuff. So bear with me. As the year goes on, we will chip through all types of hyper, intra, whatever word you want to put in front of it, dimensional beings that you can, super dimensional. It's insane how many there are out there, but it's quite an interesting subject though. So who brought us the knowledge of this? Who was the first person to really start tying this together? But besides the native tribes around the world, we had a man called Terence McKenna who started piecing all this information together from the different tribes around the world and from the different experiences he had had and interviews he had done. Now, Terence McKenna was a ethnobotanist and a mystic who advocated for the responsible use of naturally occurring psychedelic plants. He spoke and wrote about a variety of subjects, including psychedelic drugs, plant-based ethnogens, shamanism, metaphysics, alchemy, language, philosophy, culture, technology, environmentalism, and the theoretical origins of human consciousness. He was called the Timothy Leary of the 90s, one of the leading authorities on the ontological foundations of shamanism, and the intellectual voice of rave culture. McKenna formulated a novelty theory regarding the nature of time based on fractal patterns, which he claimed to discover in the I Ching, and predicting a transition of consciousness in the year 2012. Despite the pseudoscientific nature of novelty theory, promotion of its ideas and its connection to the Maya calendar helped fuel widespread beliefs about the 2012 eschatology, which was the idea that we were going to basically apocalypse in 2012. And then they do that thing on the screen where they switch the one and the two around and everyone's like, oh my God, they meant 2021. No. who knows what's around the corner, eh? So Terence McKenna was born and raised in Pinoia, Colorado, with Irish ancestry. On his father's side of the family, McKenna developed a hobby of fossil hunting in his youth, and from this he acquired a deep scientific appreciation of nature. He also became interested in psychology at a young age, reading Carl Jung's book Psychology and Alchemy at the age of 14. This was the same age McKenna first became aware of magic mushrooms when reading an essay titled Seeking Magic Mushrooms, which appeared in the May 13, 1957 edition of Life magazine. So 14 and he's discovering magic mushrooms. At age 16, McKenna moved to Los Altos, California to live with family friends for a year. He finished high school in Lancaster, California in 1963. He was introduced to the literary world of psychedelics through The Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell by Aldous Huxley, and certainly issues of The Village Voice, which published articles on psychedelics. Now, Los Altos, California. That's an interesting, almost a, seems like a nexus point, doesn't it? There's so many stories we've done over the last 2 years that have been Los Altos has come up in there somewhere, whether it's ufological, cryptids, or paranormal. We always seem to... There's so many stories that tie to Los Altos, but maybe it's just because it's a highly populated area. If you have any, I'm Australian, so if you have any information about Los Altos and its weird history or anything, please send it through to me. I'm really interested in learning more about that. In 1965, McKenna enrolled in the University of California, Berkeley, and was accepted into Tuskman Experimental College. In 1967, while in college, he discovered and began studying shamanism through the study of Tibetan folk religion. The same year, which he also called his opium and Kabbalah phase. He traveled to Jerusalem, where he met Kathleen Harrison, an ethnobotanist who would later become his wife. So the guy was very, very well traveled. He started gathering his data and information collecting as he went along. So McKenna would eventually go into a bit of a depression after his mother died from cancer in 1970. He would then start... searching for the ukihe, a plant preparation containing dimethyltryptamine, DMT. Instead of the ukihe, they found fields of gigantic psilocybin mushrooms, which became the new focus of the expedition. In La Correra, at the urging of his brother, McKenna was the subject of a psychedelic experiment, which the brothers attempted to bond harmine. Harmine is another psychedelic compound they use synergistically with the mushrooms, with their own neural DNA. Through the use of a set of specific vocal techniques, they hypothesized that this would give them the access to the collective memory of the human species and would manifest the alchemist philosopher's stone, which they viewed as the hyperdimensional union of spirit and matter. McKenna claimed the experiment put him in contact with Logos, an informative divine voice he believed was universal to visionary religious experience. McKenna was also often referred to the voice as the mushroom, the teaching voice, amongst others. The voice's reputed revelations and his brother's simultaneously peculiar psychedelic experience prompted him to explore the structure of an early form of the I Ching, which led to his novelty theory. During their stay in the Amazon, McKenna also became romantically involved with his interpreter, Ev. In 1972, McKenna returned to UC Berkeley to finish his studies, and in 1975, he graduated with a degree in ecology, shamanism, and the conservation of natural resources. Now, I never even knew you could get a degree in shamanism, but there you go. In the autumn of 1975, after parting with his girlfriend, Ev, earlier in the year, McKenna began a relationship with his future wife and the mother of his two children, Kathleen Harrison. Soon after graduating, McKenna and Dennis published a book inspired by their Amazon experiences, The Invisible Landscape, Mind Hallucinogens, and I Ching. The brothers' experiences in the Amazon would later be the main focus of McKenna's book, True Hallucinations, published in 1993. McKenna also began lecturing locally around Berkeley and started appearing on some underground radio stations. So you got to remember, this is like... a lot of the stuff from the hippie era had been really... shoved down. It'd been killed off. The idea of the hippies were starting to get wiped out. The 80s were coming in. We were seeing things like cocaine use becoming a lot higher. Things like heroin, stuff like that, starting to hit the market more. So these ideas of these natural things were starting to go away, and you had a lot more influential and rich people using these man-made drugs rather than these hallucinogens. A lot of people had too many drugs probably during the 60s and 70s, and they had moved on to the next level. So they weren't getting anything out of the DMT or out of the magic mushrooms, anything like that. So it's so he's then saying that we're trying to show that you shouldn't be overusing this stuff. This isn't to be abused. So he was then sort of painted with the brush of drug user. He was painted with the brush of, just your normal druggy after a high. The scientific world shunned him, essentially. The botany world you know, talking about people who were interested in trees and flowers. Like, it's not really so much about what he was into. So he was really shunned for quite a while. So he ended up being pushed into underground radio, where he started, like, still providing his information. A lot of the universities wouldn't have him speak or lecture. And so he'd end up having to do these workshops and these tours. And he'd start promoting natural psychedelics as a way to explore universal mysteries, to simulate imagination, stimulate rather the imagination, and establish a harmonious relationship with nature. Though associated with the New Age and human potential movements, McKenna himself had little patience for New Age sensibilities. He repeatedly stressed the importance and primacy of the felt presence of direct experience as opposed to dogma. So what he's saying there is he wanted people to actually experience these things and not listen to the dogma of this is how it works, this is what happens, the science book tells me so. And he had the science to back it as well. Like, this is the thing that gets pushed down about McKenna, is that he was definitely up there with great minds when it came to botany and this ethnobotany. But being tarred and feathered didn't help him much at all. In addition to psychedelic drugs, McKenna spoke on a wide array of subjects, including shamanism, which that hurt him again, metaphysics, alchemy, language, culture, self-empowerment, environmentalism, techno-paganism, artificial intelligence, evolution, extraterrestrial science and scientism, the web, virtual reality, and atheistic theory, specifically without art, visual experience as information representing the significance of hallucinatory visions experienced under the influence of psychedelics. So have a read of some of his stuff. Honestly, dig into this guy. I might do a whole profile on him eventually. But some of the stuff he was saying about virtual reality and the web, well before it became this machine, this monster that we all know it to be now, was really interesting. And he doesn't really talk much about AI. It wasn't really something that I could find that he spoke about. But his thoughts on virtual reality, very interesting. Essentially, the idea of what is the difference between an electronic thing being plugged to your head and stimulating endorphins in your brain and taking a trip. So it's still something that makes me go, no, I'm not going to do it, but it's definitely an interesting way of putting it. He would actually go in and show the damage that something like virtual reality, if used for extended periods of time, could have a negative effect on the brain, disassociation and things like that with life. And that sort of gets into the whole subject of how much does a video game control. I don't believe that video games kill people. I don't believe it trains kills or anything like that. But I do believe, I have seen this firsthand, where even with my children, I've had to pull them up and say, hey, enough. Let's slow down the video games for one day. Where there's a disassociation with reality and what's happening on the screen. Their reality becomes what's inside that box and not what's around them. And so he was very much speaking to the idea that there's a way to have a bit of each. You know, you can stimulate these endorphins in your brain, but you don't want to be the hamster pressing that button and get an electric shock expecting another endorphin hit. It's something to think about anyway. Alrighty, so we're going to go to a quick break so I can have a bit of coffee and clear my throat. After the break, we'll be talking about ethnobotanism or ethnobotany, Rick Strassman, and we're going to be going into a few stories and what some of these scientific experiments found over the years, and could these machine elves actually be real? Who knows? Right now, we're going to be listening to a really good tune by Punk Rock Opera. A lot of you who tune in quite a bit know that I actually really, really enjoy Punk Rock Opera's music. I would love to be able to interview them one day. So here's their song, I Want to Be a Machine Elf. Thank you.
Yes, I wanna be a machine. If you're a machine, it can't be so bad. 'Cause no one built you to be sad. And in my cold, still heart, I'd know I was built to be alone. A steel body can't go to hell when you got no soul left to sell. I feel broken and beaten down, like I'm chased by the devil's hound. And in my cold, still heart, I know I was built to be alone.
Welcome back to the second half of the Oddball Aussie podcast, where we're talking about Machine Elves. That was Punk Rock Opera with their song, I Want to Be a Machine. No, it's not called I Want to Be a Machine Elf. I was just mucking around. So I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We're getting into a bit more of the science behind the ideas now, so it should be a very interesting episode. All right, so we talked about McKenna and Terence McKenna, basically being the man who bought all this to the surface, really made it a popular thing. There's a few other people names as well, but they mentioned that he was an ethnobotanist. So ethnobotany is the study of a region's plant and their practical uses through the traditional knowledge of a local culture and people. An ethnobotanist thus strives to document the local customs involving the practical use of local flora for many aspects of life, such as plants as medicine, food, intoxicants, and clothing. Richard Evans Schultz, often referred to as the father of ethnobotany, explained the discipline in this way. Ethnobotany simply means investigating plants used by societies in various parts of the world. So essentially, yeah, you're going to be using it to figure out how they use plants as medicines, plants as clothing, plants as everything. It's quite an interesting concept, and a very important thing too, because a lot of these cultures that due to negative effects on their environment, negative effects from other cultures, this has caused them to decline. And a lot of these practices get lost to history. So it's good when we can actually get hold of all these practices and see and remember what they actually do. And this tied into McKenna's shamanism quite a bit as well. Now, another big name in all of this was Rick Strassman. Rick Strassman is an American clinical associate professor of psychiatry in the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. He has held fellowship in clinical psychopharmacology research at the University of California, San Diego, and was professor of psychiatry for 11 years at the University of New Mexico. After 20 years of intermission, Strassman was the first person in the United States to undertake human research with psychedelic, hallucinogenic, or ethogenic substances in which in his research, which involved DMT. He also authored the book DMT, The Spirit Molecule, which summarizes his academic research into DMT and other experimental studies of it, and includes his own reflections and conclusions based on this research. And it's quite interesting, the United States and their study on psychedelic, hallucinogenic, and ethogenic substances, because that's something we're going to get into eventually. There's more and more stories coming forward about soldiers and about CIA operatives, people of that nature, who were being tested throughout this. A lot of people relate this to MKUltra. And it's quite an interesting part of history. And to think that it stopped, I don't think so. So a lot of the stuff that used to happen in the past was spiking people's drinks, would be giving them drugs, making them believe they were giving them something else, and then watching their reactions and things like this. It was how to use DMT and these other psychedelics and ethogenics as a weapon or as a control mechanism. So it's quite an interesting study, and we will be getting into that this year. Whether or not iTunes likes it, we're going to be diving into a bit of conspiracy stuff, but I've got to get all my ducks in a line first before we really crack into it. Anyway, more on Rick Strassman. He's, as an undergraduate at Stanford, working in the developmental biology laboratory of Norman K. Wessel, Strassman developed a new model of growing embryonic avian dorsal root ganglion neurons suspended in a semi-solid agar matrix, thus allowing a three-dimensional assessment of growing patterns. Using this model, he discovered non-random pattern of growth of the leading edge of the cells. So if McKenna was the hands-on researcher, this man is definitely still hands-on, still experimental, but definitely had the book smarts to do with the DMT. So from 1990 to 1995, Strassman led a government-funded clinical research team at the University of New Mexico. So that's not that long ago, 1990 to 1995. And it's the effects of DMT on a human subject in experimental conditions. The research continued from his work on melatonin. Strassman's studies between 90 and 95 aimed to experimentally investigate DMT's effects. DMT is a powerful psychedelic drug found in hundreds of plants and every mammal that has been studied. So as a result of his research, Strassman came to call DMT the spirit molecule because its effect included many features of religious experiences, such as visions, voices, disembodied consciousness, powerful emotions, novel insights, and feelings of overwhelming significance. During the project's 5 years, he administered approximately 400 doses of DMT to nearly 60 human volunteers. Strassman was the first to administer legally psychedelics to people in the United States in 20 years. And his research has widely been regarded as kicking off the psychedelic renaissance, in which many psychedelic compounds have begun to be significantly studied for the first time since the early 1970s. Strassman characterized DMT's biological and psychological effects in his first offset, rather, of dose response studies, effects consistent with activation of central and or peripheral serotonin receptors. His team published a companion article describing the psychological effects and preliminary results of a new rating scale, the hallucinogen rating scale, the HRS, researchers have widely accepted the HRS as a sensitive and specific measure of the psychological effects of a wide variety of psychoactive substances, with over 45 articles documenting its use of mid-2015. A follow-up study demonstrated lack of tolerance of the psychological effects of repeated, closely spaced doses of DMT, making it unique among classical psychedelics. So, that last part there, DMT definitely works in a very different way, and the lack of tolerance would mean that people would be taking these things in repeated doses, in space, closely spaced together, but weren't tolerating it. They weren't becoming getting over the drug. They weren't becoming dead to it. They were actually having the same experiences over and over again. So Strassman has detailed in his research book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule, and produced a 2010 documentary film on the same name based on this book. He also conducted similar research in psilocybin and psychedelic alkaloids found in hallucinogenic mushrooms. He's definitely not one who got into the alien stuff or the God stuff. He believes it has a connection to the God story, to the idea of where gods came from. In that sense, he means psychologically. He's not talking about there being actual gods. He's talking about it being a psychological thing that people have misinterpreted. So it's quite interesting. He has a whole different take on the subject, but at the same time comes down to similar, it's almost exact same results as McKenna, but one goes into the metaphysical and one stays in the scientific, which I guess metaphysical is still scientific, but in the same way. So one's more, I'd say McKenna's more your pseudoscience at the end, but uses actual scientific research. Whereas Strassman definitely stuck with the science, no, nothing else. This is what it is. So we talked about these at the start. Since we're talking about scientists, these aren't quite scientists, but they're very interesting. So it's called a psychonaut, and the act of psychonautics, or the position, I don't know. So it refers to both to mythology or for describing and explaining the subjective effects of altered states of consciousness, especially an important subgroup called holotropic states, including those included induced by meditation or mind-altering substances, and to a research cabal in which the researcher voluntarily immerses themselves into an altered mental state in order to explore the accompanying experiences. The term has been applied diversely to cover all activities by which altered states are induced and utilized for spiritual purposes or the exploration of the human condition, including shamanism, lamas of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, sensory deprivation, and archaic modern drug users who use etherogenic substances in order to gain deeper insights and spiritual experiences. A person who uses altered states for such exploration is known as a psychonaut. So, clinical psychiatrist Jan Dirk Blom describes psychonautics as denoting the exploration of psyche by means of techniques such as lucid dreaming, brainwave entrainment, sensory deprivation, and use of hallucinogenics or etherogens. So, this is really interesting because I guess in a way I'm a psychonaut. Well, I don't use any drugs, but the lucid dreaming, I definitely try to bring on lucid dreaming without the use of drugs. It is doable. And I have been practicing that, and I have actually been getting some very, very lucid dreams lately. So I guess in that sense, I'm maybe not a psychonaut, maybe just a psycho. No, maybe just a lucid dreamer, I guess. But it's interesting nonetheless that this doesn't necessarily mean the use of drugs. So psychologist Dr. Elliot Cohen of Leeds Beckett University and the UK Institute of Psychosomanautics defines psychonautics as the means to study and explore consciousness, including the unconscious and altered states of consciousness. It rests on the realization that to study the consciousness is to transform it. He associates it with a long tradition of historical cultures worldwide. Leeds Beckett University offers a module in psychonautics and may be the only university in the UK to do so. So it's definitely something that people do. And a psychonaut is someone who gets out there and tries these things to try to explore and research their own human psyche. It's quite an interesting thing. But that's something I learned while going through this, was a psychonaut doesn't necessarily mean they take drugs. That's interesting. So what sort of research have we actually discovered over the years about this sort of stuff? So there's been a lot of people researching over the years, and a lot of people come up with different ideas. So there's been some results. So the encounters produced an emotional response for 99% of people. And this study comes from the Journal of Psychopharmacology. And they did a survey including responses from 2,561 adults about their single most memorable encounter with a being or beings after smoking or vaporizing DMT. Most respondents had used DMT about a dozen times in their life. The survey excluded experiences in which people consumed other drugs with DMT, and it didn't include experiences with ayahuasca, which is a brew that contains DMT. So this is pure DMT. No taking DMT and then and having a blunt. No taking DMT and snorting some lines. It's just pure DMT. So the encounters produced an emotional response for 99% of the people. The most common emotions were joy at 65%, trust at 63%, surprise at 61%, love at 59%, kindness 56%, friendship 48%, and fear 41%. So it's fear is right in the middle there. During the encounter experience with smaller proportions, reporting emotions such as sadness was 13%, distrust 10%, disgust 4%, and anger at 3%. So anger was a very, very, very tiny group. Interestingly, 58% of the respondents said that the being also had an emotional response, almost always a positive one. So this, remember, this is just people who have had an experience with a being, so a machine elf when they've been under. The encounters felt more real than reality. 81% of the respondents said that this was true. There was an indescribable powerful notion that the dimension in which the entity and I convened was infinitely more real than the conscious reality I usually inhabit. It felt truer than anything else I'd ever experienced. And this is very interesting. Those of you who are thinking that sort of triggers a thing in many people's brains, the whole Matrix idea that everything is a created illusion. This is essentially what they're saying, is that they went to a place that was more real than what we're actually living in now. Quite interesting. But once again, is that purely our serotonin levels telling us that? So people describe the entities in different ways. The most commonly chosen labels were being, guide, spirit, alien, or helper. Other labels selected by small proportions of respondents include, this is between 10 and 16% of people said they used the word angel, elf, religious, personage, or plant spirit, and very few reported the terms gnome, monster, or deceased person. So elf wasn't really held up there in that high regard. And this is interesting, because remember this when we go into a bit more of this research. So most people said the beings weren't hallucinations. Most of them said that they felt like these actually were physical things that that existed. Only 9% said the being existed completely within myself. So that's 91% said that the being existed out of themselves. It actually existed. So most described the beings positively. When asked about the attributes of the entity, a majority of the sample reported that the entity was conscious, intelligent, benevolent, sacred, and had agency in the world. So actually had control in the world, and was positively judgmental. Fewer reported that the entity was petitionable, negatively judgmental, and malicious, which sort of goes against what some people have said, and including McKenna himself, about them being tricksy or being dangerous. So, but he also did say they were fun. So it's definitely a line, and that may have just been his personal experience with it. So most received a message during the encounter. About two-thirds of respondents said that they received a message, task, mission, or purpose, or insight from the entity encounter experience. What kinds of messages? Some people were shown that death isn't the end, that everything and everyone is connected. Others had personal insights revealed to them, such as bad behaviors they should stop. Some messages were strangely practical. One respondent said the beings revealed the location of a Zippo lighter that had been missing. It was buried deep in a couch, go figure. There was also the respondent who said a being was teaching me the rules and regulations of the NFL. Now, this is where my mind goes to the idea that this is information that we already know, that we've already absorbed. So anyone who's grown up and had football playing in the background with their parents, who's never watched football, as soon as someone starts, been explained the rules of football, as soon as someone starts to explain the rules to them, their brains will then connect the dots and go, oh, okay, so that's why that guy's doing this, that's why that guy's doing that. Even if it's not verbally, their brain will start connecting the dots of what they see. It's the whole thing of pareidolia. If I show you a piece of toast and I just say, what do you see here? They'll say a piece of toast. If I say, but if you see here, you can see a beard and you can see Jesus' eyes and Jesus' face, and now he's riding a jet ski. You will probably see that if I point that out to you, because your brain will associate what I've just shown you to what I've just told you. So the same thing happens, I believe, with this. Now, other things like bad habits, I think this is something that we know deep down. We know if we have a bad habit for biting our nails. We don't need to be told that, but subconsciously, we tuck it away and we go, no, we don't have a problem. And then this drug seems to, it seems to be our subconscious. This is my mindset on it. Maybe all this machine elf stuff is real. I don't know. But my belief is, from never taking it, admittedly, never took it, but my belief is that it's a separation of your current consciousness and your subconsciousness. So it's essentially you're speaking to your own subconscious, and your subconscious is where we store all those things we don't like to think about. That's where we put the ideas of death. That's where we put our ideas of divorce. That's where we put our ideas. Every time you want to tuck something away, we tuck it into our subconscious, and that gets stored. Everything we've ever known is stored somewhere in our brain. Every experience, every memory, the first thing you saw when you're a baby is stored somewhere in your brain. It just never gets used. So we believe that we forgot it. But really, it is in there somewhere. These things don't just disappear. And it's interesting that we look at this and we go, this is more of a conversation with our own subconscious, in my opinion. And the whole Zippo lighter being left in the couch, that could easily be, where did I find my Zippo lighter last 10 times when I lost it? Oh, yeah, it was in the couch. But because we're so eager to believe something else, we may tend to rationalize these things by looking at the weird rather than looking at what actually exists. I could also be completely wrong, and there is a big, weird, extraterrestrial, interdimensional being that talks to people while they're on drugs. It could be that too. I'm not here to judge, but definitely since I haven't actually experienced it. But that's sort of what I'm gathering from all the stuff I'm reading, is it definitely seems to be like a subconscious conversation. So the encounters were often followed by lasting changes in well-being and beliefs. Now this one's pretty much across the board. Almost 90% of people changed things that they had experienced. So they had been told that this is damaging you, like smokers had given up smoking, people who were aggressive and controlling became less so, or stopped, became better people. So there is a thing to be said that I've heard a few people say, well, if we just gave all the world leaders DMT, maybe we could get them all back down to earth. Well, this isn't completely false. I mean, the separation of ego is what happens. And most people who get to a position of power get there because they have to have ego. You sort of, in this day and age, to get to a place of power within the government, you really have to have an ego. You have to have an ego if you're going to be campaigning for votes and things like that. Even the most person, even the person who just doesn't seem to have an ego at all, once you dig down, you'll find that they do. And they've probably got a bigger ego than people who are wearing their ego on their sleeve. And maybe this is a drinking game now, how many times I can say ego. But a lot of people who actually are an outward person who show an egotistical side, that's the breadth of their ego. It doesn't go any further than that. Many people who hide away their ego have a deeper thought of themselves and think more of themselves than what they probably should. But in saying that, I do think everyone should believe in themselves. But there are people out there who will hide their ego as an arrogance. And it's an arrogant way of going, well, I don't need bravado. I don't need to show my ego because I'm better than you anyway. So people who go through these ayahuasca, through the DMT, even the ones who don't seem egotistical will separate their ego, and that it will show them something, and they'll freak out over it, and it will change them. Almost 90% of people who went through this. I mean, I'm not saying we need to give all the world leaders DMT, but it's quite an interesting change in it, aren't they? So where do we really sit? It's an interesting thing. It's 50-50, honestly. There's so many facts I read that make me want to go, yes, 100%, DMT elves exist. There's the other side of me that goes, it just can't. Like, it's just your own brain. I know how powerful a person's brain is. A person can go their whole lives telling themselves they went to a concert they never went to because they weren't even born yet. And subconsciously, they'll store data from watching film clips, from watching reading books, from watching videotapes, things like that. They will store this data, and then they will slowly build this this belief in their own head. Starts with the floor, then they build the walls, and they build the ceiling and the roof, and eventually they have this thought in their head that, yep, I was there, I was in row 12, I was there when they did this in the show. I found a guitar pick, but I must have dropped it on the way home. And there are people who are that, wouldn't say in control of their consciousness, because essentially they've let their consciousness have free will. But there's people that can do that. There's people that are strong enough to will away pain. There are Buddhist monks out there who can not feel pain, because they will it away. They change their brain. They change their mindsets. And they could. There's videos of them getting cracked on the back with a whip, and they don't feel it. They don't even flinch, because they've gotten to a state of consciousness where they've separated the feeling of pain and the emotion of pain. And it's quite an interesting thing. It's a whole nother thing we could go into in the future. But before we finish up, though, so we've got a few concepts here that I've read. So this is against McKenna. So the whole thing about this is that this is what one set of people believe. And this is probably the best thing I found that summarizes what a lot of people believe. And this is from a Reddit page. The whole thing about this is that Terrence's machine elf meme implants the thought in your head so that you'll automatically try to pre-visualize what you see while under the influence. Eduardo Luna used to make a big deal about his ayahuasca tryptamine experiments and how different groups of people from different cultures all saw jaguars in their visuals. He used to give lectures on the subject to different audiences that were hungry for mystic powers of the Amazon. His studies were seriously flawed when examined in closer detail. Turns out that this was nothing more than his projection of the concept to otherwise ambiguous visual imagery that the subjects were trying to make sense of out by Luna. True, the jaguar imagery is pronounced in the Amazon tribe, self-reports, but the jaguar is a powerful metaphor for these jungle people. And it's... this isn't me saying that. So, Ant's reference is subject to losses in language, translation, and intended meanings. Nevertheless, there's a good story about how Luna first met R.E. Schultz at the Ethnogenic Conference. So, essentially, they're saying that this has all been projected. Now, the interesting thing I wanted to bring that point of view up. I don't really agree calling them jungle people. So the native Amazonians have this belief of seeing these jaguar, like a mythical large jaguar, as a spirit animal during these ayahuasca trips. And that's a whole another story, though. We'll be here for another hour if we dive into that, which some of you may enjoy, but I'll make that a different show. So the interesting thing I found about this, though, was that these people are saying, oh, no, there's only so many of these elf stories because it's been in the public eye for so many years. Now, where I find this deviates is from that study that we're just talking about. Now, these studies that we just spoke about were from the last 5 years, and they suggested that less than 10% of people said something other than a being or a alien or something. That was 90% of people saw it as a being or a person or a godlike character. So less than 5% of people actually said elf. So less than 10% said something other than a being and a being of like a human form or anything like that. And less than 5% said elf. So to go after this and say, oh, no, people aren't experiencing this because of, well, maybe they're not elves. Maybe that's just the word that people have attached to it. But this isn't the word that people are using. This isn't what's getting projected into their brains. Because if that was the case, more and more people would be saying elf, but that's not the case at all. We only hear the word elf because it's the most publicized. I mean, we saw people like Alex Jones talking about the clockwork elves and things like that. We've had these more out there, crazier people talking about the clockwork elves. Joe Rogan's talked about them. You know, there's so many people out there with a big platform who has discussed this, but in actual fact, there's a bigger following of people who see it as a being or a personage or a godlike character. So it's definitely goes against the grain of what one side likes to think, and there's multiple sides to this too. That's not the only one. So here's a couple of quick stories. Okay, so I just saw the time, so we're only going to do one. But this is quite a long story, so hang with me. I believe I met these things when I had my first major hallucination. Some friends and I smoked the legal plant Salvia divinorum because we had heard it was fun and could easily be bought, which mattered because we weren't old enough to buy booze. I'm not trying to say that a previous, so they're talking about previous Redditors. Anyway, first and foremost, I had no prior psychedelic experience and was not expecting one from smoking salvia. I only thought it could make me feel something similar to weed or alcohol. I also had not heard anything of mechanical elves or anything similar, as I was an inexperienced person and not part of the culture that would lead me to learn of such things. My experience. I smoked the salvia as I had been instructed to on the web, trying to hold it in as long as possible. I was sitting staring forward when all of a sudden the ceiling cracked open like it was being pulled off by giants. The light poured in from outside. The ceiling then ripped away as if it was rolling up and everything began to be pulled in with it. Imagine the way paint would spin into a whirlpool of water. I wouldn't go in one sustained glob. It would instead be distorted into a thin strand as little by little of it got pulled inward. This is the way the room and all my close friends were pulled with the ceiling. While this was going on, I was still unaware I was hallucinating all this. As I was still believing, I was waiting for it to start. Basically, I didn't realize I was tripping. So needless to say, I was very frightened. In front of the light of the outside, now exposed, which was pure white, I could see dozens of little white beings, the size of children, lining the borders of the wall, singing a repetitive song that seemed to be fueling what was happening. I felt as if I were on some sort of stage inside of a box, with all of them looking at my experience, without care of what was happening to me, which led me to believe I shouldn't either. They seemed to be trying to give me a quick lesson, as I could tell they knew the experience was constricted by time, something that shouldn't matter in a dream. As the ceiling ripped away, I realized that as if a giant broom was sweeping everything away, I could hear a noise, like that of a shore coming in and out. That was the sound of the sweeping. This is where it got much more intense. The sweeping happened and suddenly I was back in normal reality. But things were all different. like I was with the same friends, but we had different history or something. I settled my thoughts and convinced myself I'm confused, but the sweeping happened again. This happened many times, each to different perceived realities, with longer and longer periods between sweepings. Each sweeping felt like being rolled underneath a moving car, and during each one I could feel and see reality being rolled up like a flat white paper with me inside. I think the little white gnomes wanted me to learn to stop acting so distressed by the world being taken away and just accept it. Eventually I woke up. When this happened, it was just like the other perceived awakenings, the other different realities I kept waking up in, but this time it was real. Out of a legitimate fear that sweeping would happen still, more I got up screaming and frightened and jumped up on the bed and hit my head. I was really scared. Eventually I calmed down and felt better. It's all chill these now. Yeah, some terrible writing there at the end. My friends told me I just sat there wide-eyed, drooling, staring forward the whole time. They got worried because I wouldn't respond at all to them, and then I snapped awake. Very strange experience. So that's, admittedly, Salvia is different from tryptamines, and Terrence was talking about the tryptamines and the molecular keys to ayahuasca. But what the person was trying to essentially say was that you can have these experiences and not be affected by other things that have been put in your head. Now, this raises a very interesting concept before we close out the show. How do you know you're not having a trip right now? How do you know that the life you're living right now, what you're experiencing right now, is real? We only know reality for what we perceive it to be. Is it a dream? Is it not a dream? Are your dreams your reality and what you live right now not reality? Have a think about that. It'll circle your brain, and it's quite a hard thing to really... It's an interesting concept to have. Is everything you feel, touch, taste real? Or is this just a perceived notion? Are we a brain in a vat? You all look after each other and stay safe out there in the weird. Good night.